Good afternoon, morning for some of you. So thank you for attending Lender Legal Update. We've certainly had a kind of interesting couple weeks here. I'm going to turn today to the decision that came in this week, which is probably, I think, the biggest of all of them, and then touch on some of the other things going on overall as we kind of go through this. Obviously, this week, PHH case was decided. But this is one of those, I know how it's been reported. This is one of those situations where a little bit of knowledge, I think, is more dangerous than none at all. And it's also one of those scenarios where reading the headlines, it doesn't do complete justice. I was always one of those guys who actually didn't just read the Cliff Notes. And this is a perfect reason why you don't do that when it comes to these issues. Because this case has been reported. And look, I mean, in some ways, this is obviously a great decision. You know, it could have been much, much worse. They could have completely agreed, you know, with Cordura's interpretation of RESPA. I mean, how bad this could have gone, right? And it did not at all go that way. But I think this is being reported as a just complete all-out victory. Let's go back to doing everything we did before. No problems. This is what RESPA means. I think you got to really look at the opinion. And when you read the opinion and recognize how the opinion came out, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, it's a lot cloudier, and I don't think it's as much of a victory as people are saying. For PHH, it's a victory. Don't get me wrong. But for the industry as a whole, it's a victory, and it's certainly not a loss, but it's not a total victory here. So let's kind of – it's a small victory, I'd argue. I'm going to first talk about the issue of how the opinion was made, and this is relevant to, and by the way, as I go through this, I'm not just going to have, this isn't, you guys know I don't usually do these esoteric theoretical discussions and get into a whole bunch of law stuff, because I think it's boring to most people for good reason. However, it's important here, and it's important to know what business to take and what risks you may want to take or avoid based on some of how this opinion was generated. So this is opinion is what we'll call the plurality. When you have an opinion, you know, you've got the court, you've got a certain number of members, and when all the members join one opinion, it's called unanimous. When the majority of members join opinion, it's called the majority opinion. And then, you know, you've got a dissent in those cases, so you could have a certain number of judges dissenting and a certain number of judges for a majority. But there are other scenarios where there's no clear majority, and you have a lot of dissenting and concurring opinions, and when there's a concurring opinion, they're joining the majority, but for different reasons. And the reason that's important is to the extent the rationales change, that instructs you on your business moving forward that, hey, this isn't exactly what they're saying. There's different ways they got there, but those ways are the aspects that you need to be aware of for how you make decisions moving forward when your facts aren't exactly the same as the one at issue at PHH. So this was a decision where there was a lot of different opinions, right? And the way they reached their conclusions affects kind of what how the practical applications of it moving forward. This is especially true in the area of the constitutionality. Okay, and that's what we'll start with. As you know, just as background, PHH, the case, the constitutionality aspect, addressed whether the CFPB was unconstitutional because it had a single director, and that director was only removable for cause by the president. And because there was such a limited way of removing him, effectively, that meant that the president didn't have enough power and the CFPB director had too much. Now, this is where this plurality sort of comes in. It's going to be important maybe a couple years down the road, and why it's I'll explain why it's important to you today in a second. They said, the majority opinion, and they said that effectively this was okay, there was precedent supporting it, and so it was all right that we had a single director kind of with all this power. But what's interesting is in the majority opinion, they downplayed how important for cause was. And the court basically said, you know, for cause, yeah, it's for cause, but in the context of how it's defined, which is essentially inefficiency or dereliction of duty, that type of thing, okay? The exact words are inefficiency, malfeasance, or neglect. Okay. So it, that standard is not as high, and the president can, I mean, the president can't do it merely for policy considerations. Those are different, but it's not an impossible standard, and so it's not too terrible. Okay. But some of the concurring opinions went far past that. And one of the concurring opinions in particular kind of interpreted what the majority said and said, listen, let me be clear. All that for cause means is that you have to give them in this context, is you have to give them notice and give them a reason. But once you've done that, you know, inefficiency means almost anything. And yet another opinion that concurred said, by the way, even though I'm not totally agreeing that the standard is so low as they're saying, which is just basically you don't like the way he's doing his job, which is essentially the way he characterized the other opinions, it doesn't really matter because no one would be, I'm paraphrasing, but the fact that the court said it was kind of interesting, dumb enough to actually challenge a sitting president and saying you don't have the right to fire me because they'd always lose. So, I mean, think about what they just said. They said, we are deciding that the five-year term is only removable at will and that it's unconstitutional. But then what they did is they took out the term at will, for cause, and they effectively said, but cause isn't that much. Now, why does this matter to you, and why is this not just an esoteric discussion I'm having? Probably should have started there, but... you know, the issue here is relevant to you because to the extent people are making decisions now and saying, hey, the CFPB has stepped back, right? And it's true. Clearly we've seen it, you know, over the last couple of weeks what's been going on. So clearly there's no question the CFPB is taking a step back in terms of its enforcement. And so you might say, you know, this is great. We're going to have 5 years of this. Maybe, maybe not. Let's say politically things change. You know, that this perspective politically that's driving the CFPB does not remain ingrained for 5 years. Maybe it's 3 years, okay, or 2 years or whatever. I don't know. Here's the problem. By what the court did today, you're not guaranteed anymore a five-year term for the director at all, I don't believe. Because they essentially, the court, while it said, hey, the structure is constitutional, one of the reasons why the structure is constitutional is this whole for-cause firing requirement isn't such a big deal after all. So think about it. If the court had said the CFPB was unconstitutional, and just like the other opinion had declared, you can't have it, the president has to be able to fire the CFPB director at will, right? That's what the other opinion said, and everybody kind of championed that. All this court did is not all that different. All the majority said is, well, because firing for cause isn't that big of a deal, and by the way, all you have to do is give somebody notice, or, oh, by the way, all you have to do is be able to explain why you think they're not efficient in their job or why you don't think they're doing a good job, or, you know, by the way, hint, hint, no one's ever going to challenge a sitting president because you're going to lose. Putting all those together in a nice little bundle, right? They've so eroded in this particular context the idea of for-cause termination. They've essentially made it at will plus just a little bit. So if you go back to the beginning, square one, when you analyze this, square one where we started from was the president should be able to fire, another one, I say square one, the opinion of the court prior to going on the in-bank review. The court said there, hey, the president has to be able to fire this person at will. This in-bank opinion said, no, that's not true. For cause is fine, but it's because for cause isn't such a big deal anyhow. So what really happened was, yes, it's a five-year term. It's only terminable for cause, but pretty much the president's going to be able to do it if they want to. What this means for you in sort of assessing how long are we going to be under this regime is we're going to be under this regime effectively until the politics change, and then whoever gets in charge next, if the political change is different, is going to be able to say the person below them or the person who's directing the CFPB at this time isn't doing their job. Here's why. And they'll probably be able to remove him for cause because of all the – because basically the court weakened that for-cause provision so much that it's not a big deal and it's not an easy hurdle to get over. So what this means for you is I think at the end of the day, when you're making a decision of, you know, how long are we going to be under this political establishment or this mindset, I don't think you can say it's going to be 5 years. It's going to be as long as the politics are such that it's permitted to be or allowed to be, however you want to, you know, look at it that way. As soon as the political winds shift, which eventually one day they will, right, we all know it goes back and forth, whenever that happens, the court has essentially given the new president a roadmap on how to get rid of the director of the CFPB whenever they feel like it. In essence, not all that much changed from the opinion before, just how you got there. And that's why I sort of gave you that whole background for what I was saying. So again, understand what's been written in the papers and what you've said, seen, that's all correct. But when you take a deeper reading of this, you cannot in any way assume that whoever's the director of the CFPB this year or next year, if the president's change or anything like that, you know, the political climate changes, is going to stay in charge. I think as soon as that changes, the roadmap has absolutely been laid out in these cases for the president, whoever that may be, to put whoever they want to under the standard in charge. So that's kind of that aspect. And what that means is, again, you need to be cognizant and not just assume that, hey, the way it is today is going to be the way it is 5 years from now. Take into account as you make decisions and as you may be considering becoming less conservative in certain areas, not suggesting you should or you shouldn't, that's kind of a topic for another day, but as you make these decisions, you need to be cognizant of the statute of limitations, right? Because what you do today has, whether it has tails or whatever you want to call it, they, you know, 3 years from, for example, a fair lending case, they can go back 5 years. Right. So if in 3 years from now and you know, you do whatever you do the next 3 years, you don't do your regressions, you don't really care, you're saying, hey, I don't have to worry about the CFPB anymore. You know, if that's sort of the mindset, again, not saying you should be, but I'm sure there are people out there thinking that, you know, the reality is if somebody else gets in charge in 3 years and they now want to replace the head of the CFPB and bring everything back plus five, they're going to be able to do it. So be aware of that as you sort of make your planning short-term and long-term. Know there may be a hangover to the party, as you say, right? When it comes to the constitutionality of the CFPB. Now, when we go to the next issue, the RESPA, which might be one that you guys are more interested in to some extent, you know, I think there's similarly a way you have to be careful of not overreading the decision. Now, the decision in many parts has been that, hey, Cordray was wrong, the old interpretation of RESPA applies, and, you know, we're kind of done with it. Again, not really exactly what the court said. I'm going to actually pull up the opinion and read exactly to you the words, because I think they're pretty instructive here. So let me see if I can get this open for you. Okay, so obviously, so if you haven't read the opinion, by the way, the opinion, basically the whole opinion when it came down to RESPA was all of like two or three paragraphs out of 250, well, the majority opinion, I guess, was 80 pages. This was like three paragraphs. This is a page. They didn't talk about RESPA. They talked about constitutionality. But I want to hear, I'm going to read something to you so you understand exactly what it says, because remember, if in 3 years from now somebody brings up a RESPA claim for an MSA or something else and litigates it and cites to this case, it's very important that you understand exactly the wording used because it is not nearly as broad as I think it's being reported. What the court said here is, the panel was unanimous in overturning director's interpretation. It held that Section 8 permits captive reinsurance arrangements so long as mortgage insurers pay no more than reasonable market value for reinsurance. It gives some cites. And then you go down, and what they say a little bit further, getting down here. We accordingly decide only the constitutional question. The panel opinion, insofar as it related to the interpretation of RESPA and its application to PHH and Atrium in this case, is accordingly reinstated. So what they just said is, here's the holding, And they really described it narrowly, right? The holding is that when there's captive reinsurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we're not going to disturb that holding. So in 3 years, when you start arguing, you know, with every agency or wherever it might be about RESPA and what it means, and somebody cites this opinion in favor of your position saying that, hey, RESPA isn't as broad, the only thing they're going to be able to very effectively come back to say is, listen, they didn't decide this. All they said is captive reinsurance arrangements. This opinion can be narrowed dramatically in the future. Now, could it be expanded upon? Sure. I do think one thing that's also mentioned in here in this couple of paragraphs said both, well, I'll first say it narrows it further, is there's one of the paragraphs talks about the fact that in captive reinsurance arrangements, borrowers really don't have a choice to shop in captive reinsurance arrangements. As long as the borrowers aren't paying more, essentially it's a market dominated almost exclusively by these types of captive arrangements. There's almost no market to go out. And they laid all that out in the background in the paragraph, preceding paragraph, before even saying this. So there's a lot of factual narrowing here. So that if you were to have a case where, you know, somebody was arguing, hey, it violated RESPA because there was this MSA and it deprived borrowers of the opportunity meaningfully to shop for a lender, that scenario where you had a market that was functioning, where the borrowers had choice, I think is extremely easily distinguishable from the case here. Now, on the positive side of it, there's an aspect of it that talks about, in this case, that, hey, you know, insofar as the CFPB is saying that when there's some type of arrangement and it doesn't actually cost the borrowers more money, even if there is some type of aspect of this arrangement that's based on fair market value and it has an additional impact that it drives business, that is in and of itself is not enough to make it illegal. I do believe the court has some language in here that certainly supports that. But again, if you want to look at a narrowly way to hold and look at this case, they gave somebody in the future, the government, whoever you want to say, really the opinion to narrow this case considerably. Again, there is some language, I think, in this opinion, short little sentence or two, that is definitely supportive, lightly, of the point that, hey, if you got fair market value and you can't show customers are paying more, you're probably okay, even if it has a indirect benefit of driving business to a particular entity. That's not enough to be illegal. Again, there's definitely language for that, okay? But I just wouldn't put it in the bank, so to speak, pardon the pun, that this opinion ends the issue, because there's definitely room for debate further. So what does this, again, mean for your business when it comes to marketing, co-marketing, so forth and so on? You know, I did say the CFE is stepping back. That's true. But, you know, especially in the era of this RESPA and co-marketing and MSAs, the states have become and have been for some time more active, I think, than even the federal government. There have been multiple lawsuits by states banding together, you know, all these types of things. I remember under Dodd-Frank, they can still bring UDAP claims, and there's some that have done that. And so when you look at that type of scenario, you say, okay, well, you know, are we now protected? And you look at this case, and I can't tell you that you're completely protected at all, because somebody who wants to interpret this narrowly and just look at the court's words has an easy way of doing it, right? And now you're in where you don't want to be. So what do you do with that? Look, I think that, and I've thought all along, and you guys all know this, said it many times, that you could do MSAs if you knew how to do them right. I've always said you can do co-marketing if you have to do it right. And I know there have been other people that felt like, well, so unpredictable and so risky that, you know, you just can't take these chances, you know, because it's so undefined. Has some risk been taken out of the water? Yeah, I think a little bit. But I certainly don't think enough to say, oh, relax, don't worry, it's the good old days, or even anything close to that. I would still, if, you know, if it was my mortgage company, so to speak, I would still really attempt to follow some of the guidance the CFPB put out there in terms of creating these MSAs. I still think it's incredibly important to get a fair market valuation in any type of the marketing stuff that you're doing. I think it's important to set it up in such a way that there is a benefit somewhere that you could argue to a consumer, or at least it's marketing in the true sense of the word. Because I think that if you set up these arrangements that you could be articulated or argued to be shams, there's enough blood still left in the water that didn't get removed by this case, that somebody can come after you for it, especially and particularly a state that decides to take a narrow holding and comes in and says, hey, this is different, right? I think some people at some times get over-worried and over-panicked on certain things, and I think a little bit of that may have gone on, and so maybe that's not necessary quite as much anymore. But I don't think it's just like, well, don't worry about it. PHH1, we don't have to worry about MSAs. We can relax. I think you still have to be, frankly, equally diligent when it comes to this. And again, that's not to say that, sometimes, like, I've been accused of being paranoid, and I don't think that's true, but I do think everyone's out to get me. I'm kind of joking here when I say that. I think you still need, I don't want to use the word paranoia, but you still need a lot of caution, because there is enough left here for a state to dig their hands in, say, PHH does not apply, this is the narrow view of the holding, I'm coming after you because you deprived people, you undermined the market, et cetera, et cetera. There's certainly enough to do that. And so I don't want to discourage people from going into MSAs and doing these things, because as I said, I always believed you could do them if you did them right. What I am discouraging you from doing is saying, oh, well, I guess I don't have to worry about anything the CFPB did. I'm going to go back and pull up my old agreement from, 1998 or 2002 and start using it again and doing it and not worrying about it. That, I think, is unwise. I think that you need to be cautious. You need to be well thought out in what you're doing. You need to seek the advice of people about how you set these up and how you set this up correctly. And this applies to JVs. This applies to, which, as we know, really aren't JVs. They're independent third parties set up in an affiliated business situation. But you need to do it with co-marketing. You need to do it with MSAs. There are still enforcers out there, okay? And they're still going to be able to grab onto some of that CFPB guidance. And if you totally violate it and or you go back to just doing it, business as usual, not worrying about it at all, there's enough space to somebody come after you and change the discussion a little bit. So I think that, again, don't stay out of it just because you're scared. I don't think that, and I didn't think that that was a good reason to not do business that you could do. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be a little scared still, if that makes any sense. So these are definitely victories. Like I said, the decisions could have gone far, worse the other way. And so they are victories, there's no doubt. But they're not question-ending victories, if that makes any sense. Proceed with caution is probably how you could term this call and the advice I'm giving. And don't forget, with this stuff with MSAs and RESPA, there's another area you have to remember. I talked about statute of limitations a few minutes ago, and now they you can look back, and under RESPA it's only a year. But something you also have to remember about a lot of these laws, and it's just a case we just successfully argued this week, we found out in a RESPA case where we defeated a class action, got it dismissed, but the issue in that case, the reason I'm bringing it up, is there was equitable tolling. And the plaintiffs had said, yeah, I know it was 7 or 8 years ago, but the whole point here is they kept secret what they were doing. Nobody knew. And because they kept secret, nobody knew. And even though it's been 7 years and now we've discovered it, they should be able to bring their claims. And fortunately for my clients in this case, there were some other extenuating circumstances, not really extenuating, but some unique fact patterns that were present that we were able to utilize for to obtain a dismissal in the case. Had those facts not been there, and again, they were kind of unique, there was a real significant possibility that equitable tolling would have enabled the case to have continued. And by the way, in the past, with some other defendants and other related cases, that equitable tolling had been permitted to keep the case. Again, it should have been 1 year. Some of those cases were brought 4 and 5 years later. So, you know, the fact of the matter is that, remember in all this stuff that there are ways to get things pushed forward. So that's sort of why I'm saying proceed with caution. This is not the good old days, even though we see a lot of political things happening. It's not the good old days because in the good old days, let's just be honest, nobody really cared, right? I mean, there really weren't, you know, the mortgage companies were not a centerpiece of the news. Banks were not the centerpiece of the news in terms of everything that happened in 2008. And that those events were sort of world-changing, and at least the reasonably foreseeable future. And there are large pieces of our political machinery that have that as a focal point of their, or a centerpiece of their ticket, right? And until that changes, and until we're not subject anymore to political changing winds, I think you have to maintain that things have changed and it's not going back to the way it was. And that's a mentality to stay in mind. So, look, are things getting easier from a regulatory perspective? To some extent, yes. But it doesn't mean that you can relax and not worry about it anymore, because I think these types of issues are to some extent here to stay, both because you know, the law, it is written into Dodd-Frank. It's actually a law. It's not just a regulation, some of this stuff. States have enforcement power on laws that they didn't have before. But even more importantly, as soon as things change, those lions can rear their head again. And when they do, they can look backwards to see what happened when they weren't in charge. And that's something you've got to keep mindful and, you know, as you kind of move forward and make business decisions, both for today and for the future, you still have to be cautious. So good reasons for optimism, of course, but definitely proceed with caution. Thanks for the time today. Sorry if I went too far into some legal stuff that gets confusing, but I hope you understand why I did it and why it's important to you. So Happy New Year for everybody. I guess I didn't say that. Maybe I had last time, but I hope you guys have good luck this year, and I hope you'll join me for our session next month. Thanks.